Working Cows Podcast, Episode 57.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hey everybody, it's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. Really excited about this episode today. I've wanted to have Nicolette Hahn Nyman on for a long time. She is a former environmental lawyer turned rancher who has written a couple of books. The one that we'll be going into a little bit today with her is her book Defending Beef, which will be linked at the show notes page, workingcows.net/57. And we are going to talk a little bit about how that whole process came to be. So, Nicolette, thank you so much for your joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You have had an interesting story and a transition that is, I think, germane to the topic of our discussion today. And so I'd like to give you a little bit of a chance to share your history as it relates to your relationship to beef specifically, but, you know, animal protein as a whole as well.
Okay. Well, I'm from Michigan. I grew up there and grew up in a sort of typical suburban household. My parents were both professors at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. And I was always interested in the environment. I was interested in food as far as like eating good food. My mom was a avid home cook and had a big garden and so forth. And at some point when I started college, I was involved in environmental causes and was really interested in animal welfare issues and stuff too. And so I decided it would be a good idea to become a vegetarian based on my belief that that was better for the environment and better for health. And then I ended up going to law school. And originally when I got out of law school, I was a prosecuting attorney for a while. And then I started working for a law firm. And then I happened to attend a talk. I was also a city council member in Kalamazoo, Michigan for 2 terms. And I was, as a city council member, actually attending a talk that was being given by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of the late Senator Robert Kennedy. And he was talking all about using the law as a citizen and as a lawyer to try to help the environment. And it got me thinking about my own life and my own work and what I was passionate about. And I decided I wanted to pursue that same kind of work. And I, after my term was finished on the city council, I ended up working for the National Wildlife Federation. And they're in Ann Arbor, Michigan. They have an office there. And then I ended up having an opportunity to work for Robert Kennedy himself in the New York area, and I started, I took that job, and I moved from the National Wildlife Federation job to that job, and he asked me to start working on issues related to agriculture, specifically animal agriculture, and he had been, as an environmental lawyer, traveling around the country, encountering a lot of people where the biggest problem in their community was pollution from animal agriculture, especially concentrated, confined hog and chicken and turkey operations and some dairies. And so I accepted the job and started working on that issue. But I pretty soon after starting working on it, I realized that if we were just, sort of suing polluting hog operations, for example, then we were not really doing much to help build a better system, and that was what I was really interested in doing already at that time. So we started seeking out farmers that were doing things really well that we could hold up as examples of, you know, their environmentally appropriate way to raise animals. And I worked in that job for 2 years, and I got to know a lot of farmers and ranchers that were working around the country, but especially in the Nyman Ranch Network. And through that work, I came to know Bill Nyman, and who's the founder of the Nyman Ranch Company and that network, and also a rancher himself in California. And I ended up, after I left the job with Waterkeeper, I left the job because I wanted to do something a little bit different, and I wanted to stay in the area of animal-related issues, but I didn't want to stay in that job. So I was planning on writing a book, and I also was getting to know Bill Nyman, and then I ended up deciding to marry Bill Nyman. So I went from New York, where I was working as an environmental attorney, and I was still a vegetarian, and I moved out to California after we got married, and became Nicolette Hahn Nyman at that point. And that was 15 years ago. And once I first moved out here, I was still a vegetarian and was still an environmental lawyer, and I really thought, well, I'm going to continue my work as an environmental lawyer, and I won't be involved in the ranch, obviously, because I'm, a vegetarian environmental lawyer. So I can't be ranchy. But it was interesting because once I actually was living here and I was, kind of immersed and surrounded by what we were doing every day, I realized, not only was I okay with it, I was really interested and was really proud of what we were doing, because I could see the importance that it was having for the natural resources here. And we were, taking really good care of our animals, taking good care of our land. And I had been on a lot of other ranches at this point, too, and had seen a lot of ranchers that were doing the same thing. And so it was something I realized I was actually interested in becoming a part of. And within about a year, I was spending a lot of time working on the ranch. And for about the next 8 years, I spent most of my day every day working out on the ranch. And then we had our first son, and I started spending a little bit less time, and we actually got an additional person to help out on the ranch at that point. And I still work out on the ranch every day, but not nearly as much as I did before our two sons were born. So that's kind of my journey. And I'm, still a vegetarian at this time, but I'm not in any way opposed to the consumption of meat. In fact, I'm a big advocate of it because I think it's a really nutrient-dense, healthy food.
And so there's been a shift there from the vegetarianism being based on a desire to improve or mitigate the damage done to the climate, right? So that's...
I have to say, at the time that I made the decision, climate change wasn't being talked about very much. It was really much more about deforestation and raising animals that, purportedly used too many calories compared to how many calories were being produced and used too much land. I'm putting all this in quotes, right, because these are things I really no longer believe at all. I think these are kind of sound bites that you still hear from a lot of environmental groups and others, vegan advocates and so forth. And I really feel like there's a kind of a little tiny kernel of truth in all these ideas, but they're basically false. And so the work when I left the Waterkeeper Alliance job, that was the environmental job that I had as a lawyer, I did write a book, which was called Righteous Pork Chop, which was a description of, sort of the modern way of raising animals and an argument for a better way of doing it. But then I wrote, after writing that, and I've written a lot of other essays and articles, I was increasingly persuaded that somebody who really understood the environmental argument and the animal welfare argument also had to write something defending the raising of animals, and especially beef, because beef were really being singled out. Cattle were really being singled out, especially with respect to the climate. So my initial motivations were not really related to climate change, but they were related to this whole notion that especially cattle had this. Beef was the first thing I gave up, because I had heard over and over again they were deforesting the rainforests of Latin America. They were, taking up too much land, all this stuff, which I really don't see it like that at all anymore. And I wrote this second book called Defending Beef a few years ago, which is really laying out the argument of why not only is beef defensible, but it's actually really important, both for good land stewardship and healthy diets for humans around the world.
And so the that earlier statement you made about calories per life being a soundbite, basically, is that, I mean, like so the most ethical meat in that scenario of calories per life is like an elephant, right?
Well, that isn't what I was talking about. I was talking about this inputs versus production that you always hear. You always hear that the number of calories it takes to produce a calorie of human food is the greatest with beef cattle, because there's always this math that's done about the conversion of how much it takes to produce a pound of meat, and they say that, well, chicken's the lowest on that, but actually, you know, non-animal-based foods are better and from that perspective. So if you want to, you know, use the least resources, you're going to, and then, you know, of course, the same thing is said of water, you know, so there are always these really phony math problems that are done to show that you shouldn't be eating beef. But, you know, but sort of independent. Now, with respect to the issue you just raised, there's a really strong argument for beef on that, just on that. I mentioned that in defending beef, but I don't spend a lot of time on it. If you're going to eat chicken, I think it takes about 250 animals to produce the same amount of meat you get from killing one fully grown steer. So it's really, if you're talking about the life that you're taking compared to how much nourishment you're creating, the calculus is really clear that beef are going to be your best bet, unless, like you said, you're eating an elephant or something, which we're not doing.
Exactly.
So that's one of the many points that I make in defending beef, to say that I think from an ethical standpoint and a health and a, you know, just a land use standpoint. I mean, the main thing, you know, you obviously know this, but, and I'm sure your listeners do too, but talking about messaging and how we talk about these issues, I think this idea, there's this very widespread idea in the mainstream American population, not the agricultural community, but the other 99% of, you know, Americans that don't have agriculture that they're doing as a profession. There's this widespread idea that raising beef, especially, but, you know, the grazing animals or really any livestock, is inefficient, that it's using too many resources. And so the key point that I think we need to be stressing to people over and over again is that the vast majority of cattle grazing in the United States today is taking place on non-tillable land. And the site that the number I cite in defending beef is about 85% of cattle grazing is taking place on land where you couldn't raise crops. And then, of course, if it's the other 15%, a lot of that is taking place on land where you are raising crops for part of the time and then you're grazing the cattle. And that's a very advisable, environmentally beneficial system as well. And then, in some cases, it's on permanent pasture, which is, you know, maybe farmable land too, but it's being kept as permanent pasture for grazing. And that's a really good thing from an environmental standpoint as well, because that protective, you know, cover, if it's a year-round vegetative cover, that's probably the best thing you could have on that land from an environmental standpoint. So, you know, whether it's non-farmable land or not, there's a whole different way to look at that math equation than people are typically doing. So I'm always emphasizing to people that grazing has a unique role in the food system that is, you know, you can't simply replace it with soy or, you know, any other, you know, meat substitute. And when we do that, we're really comparing apples to oranges. When they talk about the amount of land or the amount of water, it's really not an appropriate comparison.
So when the average other 99% of the population pictures a cow-calf beef cattle operation, what images are coming to mind for them? Is it a factory farming scenario that they see, or what are they picturing when they think about these things?
Well, that's another issue that I spend a ton of time in defending you talking about this. People do not understand that all cattle are grazing, cattle, especially beef cattle. I mean, we're talking about dairy, you know, obviously different issues. But if we're talking about beef cattle, really all cattle are grazing for a substantial portion of their lives. And if you're talking about the breeding animals, of course, you're talking about nearly their entire life that they're going to be spending most of the year. I mean, it depends on obviously where you are geographically. But like in this region where we are, all cattle are out on grass, you know, all the time until the you know, the offspring of the breeding animals go somewhere to be finished on grain. Now, and there's actually a substantial portion of the operations here that are totally grass-fed too, but including our own. But even the animals that do end up being shipped to feedlots are, of course, spending up till that point, they're on grass. They're born out on pasture or rangeland, and then that's where they're growing and they're grazing until they, you know, are transported to a finishing operation. So one of the things I have discovered is that 99%, you know, talking about messaging again, they really don't understand the life cycle of the beef animal. And in fact, a few years ago, I was asked to be on the what they called the opening keynote panel for a big conference in Colorado that was for people that are mostly involved in food issues. And I asked if I could kind of start the whole conversation by explaining the life cycle of the beef cattle animal in the United States to the audience, and they agreed to let me do that because I just felt this is this huge lack of understanding, even among food professionals, you know. And so that whole idea that you have the mother cows out there pretty much for their whole lives, not in a feedlot. You know, people in their minds, they have like all of the cattle animals in feedlots and for most or all of their lives. And of course, that's just not at all correct. So I feel like emphasizing the importance of grass for the environment and for animals and for, you know, having sound food systems is really important. But then we need to explain that beef cattle animals are on grass. They're the guardians of those grasslands. And without them, not only would the ecology of that land be diminished, but also you wouldn't have the opportunity, you know, you wouldn't have the opportunity to create food off of those areas. And so, you know, it's this symbiotic relationship between the grazing animals and the grasslands. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen this kind of stuff before, Clay, but I've been really hurt to see that the Audubon Society, for example, has identified grasslands as the most important resource for protecting the most threatened type of birds in the United States today, which is the grassland bird species. And that they feel, and they say this very publicly, that the ranching community is the most important ally for them in trying to protect these birds. Because without the ranching taking place on those lands, they wouldn't remain in grasslands. I mean, that's not true in every single geography, but it's true for a lot of the areas that we're talking about. So there's another environmental group that's based here in California called Point Blue that has very active relationships with over 400 ranchers in the state of California because of that very recognition of, you know, especially birds, but also many other species that have to have these areas maintained as open natural areas. And absent the ranchers, those lands would be, you know, a lot of times in California, you're talking about development, you know, lots of pressure to develop for housing and other things. And if you take off the ranching, you don't have the economic mechanism for maintaining that as open grassland areas. So there are environmental groups that are starting to have this conversation and make the public generally understand this, but it's still, we have a long way to go. So I think that message coming from the ranching community itself is really important. And part of my passion is bridging that gap between the environmental advocates and the ranching advocates, because to me, there's not really a conflict between these two values, and we need to start figuring out how to talk about it in such a way that we show that good ranching is good environmentalism.
And how do we do that? What are some of the things that we need to start doing in the way that we're communicating? And then I think the follow-up question, just to shoot one across the bow here, is that how do we, are there practices that we need to implement so that our communication has legs or is credible?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things I said in Defending Beats that I really believe is that when, you know, any industry is comes off as strictly defensive rather than introspective, it doesn't help itself. So one of the things I really have seen coming from, you know, the mainstream trade organizations for a long time in the meat industry, including the beef industry, is messages that sound defensive and don't sound like, hey, we're committed to improving and, you know, looking at what we're doing and continuously improving. I mean, I say this all the time, and it's absolutely true. I feel like we're doing a really good job on our ranch here, but I also, my husband and I talk almost every day, but definitely every week, about things that we want to try to do things better. You know, what can we do to improve what we're doing? And I just feel like everybody, kind of in every industry, but definitely including the beef industry, needs to embrace more of that attitude of, like, what can we do better on this place where we are? And I don't, you know, in Defending Beef and in things I've written and when I give talks, I don't have the idea that there's one prescription for everybody and everybody needs to be doing X or Y. I think it's incredibly site-specific. It's incredibly climate-specific. It's incredibly specific to a given family and what their capacity is. You know, like, who's there? Who can do what, you know? I mean, I just know, again, using our own family as an example, there have been times when we were able to do more on the ranch. And then, you know, once we had two tiny children, our capacity diminished for a period of time. You know, so I've learned some of these lessons from firsthand experience. But I feel like overall the industry and individual ranchers, I mean, all of us, we need to make sure we're coming off as people that are interested in learning, always learning new things and expanding our understanding, especially I have found the most incredible expansion of ideas and knowledge comes from sort of rancher to rancher communication. I mean, I find, my husband and I always find, whenever we visit a farm or a ranch, we learn a whole bunch, you know. So I feel like, and I have only been doing this for 15 years, but my husband's been doing it for, you know, several decades now, and he doesn't know nearly as much as someone who is probably born and raised on a ranch, but he's learned a lot in those few decades. And he and I both feel like we're continuously trying to learn more and what can we do better. And so I just think the idea of continually learning and trying to improve is really important and communicating that, you know, when the beef industry is talking about itself, I think the message needs to be, we're hearing the concern and we are working on these things. So, you know, I actually have been saying in all my sort of writing and speaking for a while that the anti-beef message, I think, is really strengthened when the beef industry comes off as too defensive. You know, like, we're doing everything fine now, there is no problem. That message does not work to the mainstream public because they're hearing and seeing with their own eyes things that they think, in some cases they're wrong, but are evidence of bad environmental stewardship. I think the message should be, and it should be sincere, is we understand that our animals have environmental impacts, good and bad, and we're always trying to learn and improve. And I think, and what I'm always trying to say to the environmental community people, that, and I'm in contact with people that are very involved in the environmental community all the time, and my message is, when we say beef is bad, that makes the ranching community understandably defensive. You know? So it's all kind of fostering. You know, it's going in both. There's this whole sort of cycle. And I'm trying to tell them, don't attack ranching or grazing or beef. Instead, urge improvement in grazing practices. I think that's a really huge common ground there, because I think people that are really candid, that are very knowledgeable about ranching and grazing, will acknowledge that there's a lot of room for improvement, you know, and there are, I mean, I know, again, using our own ranch as an example, I feel like we're doing a really good job here, but I think we could be doing better, you know, in that, and we're always trying to figure out how to improve that. And we constantly get inspired by things we see other people trying or doing successfully, and, you know, we're always trying to learn more about how we can do things better. So I think that attitude and that true self-reflection, and I think it's a very, very exciting time right now with truly regenerative grazing practices being demonstrated all over the world. And I think we can all help our own operations by learning more about that and trying to do more of it. And we can also help the whole industry by showing a willingness to learn, a desire to improve, and a listening and hearing the legitimate criticisms.
Absolutely. You know, it really resonates with me as, I think, a posture of humility on both sides, but we can't, we are only responsible for how we react to whatever information comes towards us. So we can't sit around and say, well, when they humble up and they start to communicate in a nicer way to us, we will communicate. But humility.
Right, you guys be humble first, then we'll be humble. Yeah, that's not going to get us very far, is it?
No. Humility in both ways, though, is kind of, I think, what you were saying. Like, I'm humble in that I'm wanting to learn more. I'm willing to admit that I don't know everything and I can learn more. And then humility in our messaging that, hey, you know, we're trying to learn more. We're trying to do a better job of mitigating the impact of our animals on the land, and maybe even have that be a net positive, or at least a net neutral.
I'm actually a really firm believer. I mean, I don't have any doubt in my mind that the net impact of well-managed grazing is very positive. So there's an increasing body of evidence from around the world showing that when you remove grazing and you totally, you know, and this has been tried in lots of different places, and usually because they were quote-unquote trying to improve the ecological health of an area, it's been demonstrated that the overall ecological health declines. And that starts from the soil, because you not only have more biological life taking place in soils where you have grazing, again, especially when it's well-managed grazing, but even poorly managed grazing generally shows a healthier soil biology. There's more life in the soil. There are more microorganisms. There are more diverse microorganisms. And there's a great study that was done a couple of years ago that I've posted on Facebook a couple of times. It was a collaborative study done between Chinese and European researchers on a lot of different areas of land. And they found that the entire biodiversity of an ecosystem is affected by how much diversity there is in the soil biology. So when you start with a more diverse micro life, and not just micro, but macro too, so the insects and the worms and all these things, but especially those microorganisms, all of the bacteria and the fungi and the nematodes, all these little itty-bitty organisms that should be living in the soil, that live in huge numbers in healthy soil, the more diverse that is, the more diverse the vegetation will be, and the more diverse the animal life will be. So the insect life will be more diverse, the larger animals will be more diverse, and then you end up with whole ecosystems that are more biodiverse. So it's actually true, and this doesn't mean, I mean, then there's the whole issue of the water holding capacity, the amount of vegetative cover. I mean, everything is, there's this cascading effect that starts from that soil biology. So I don't have any doubt that a well-managed grazed area is going to be much healthier than an area that where you take the grazing off. So we do need to, going back to that messaging question, we need to speak about it in those terms. We need to say, it's not just that we're good at mitigating our damage. No, we are a net positive because of all these disappeared wild animals. Hmm. I mean, Alan Savory's been the one who's been articulating this so well for so long. We had huge herds of grazing animals all over the globe for much of, you know, the Earth's history, and for literally tens of millions of years. And then in the last, hundreds of thousands and tens of thousands of years, depending on what geography you're talking about, but basically fairly recently in geological time, we've lost those animals. And that was because of climate changes and because of, long before even human-caused climate change, but, you know, the ice ages changing and so forth. And then humans massively overhunted wildlife, or hunted, overhunted, depending on how you view it. But in any event, we've lost about 99% of the wild animals that cover the globe in the last few thousand years. And the grazing animals have basically been, they've basically disappeared from the planet. So that ecological impact that you had from the wild grazing animals all over the globe in huge numbers is almost gone. And so we need these domesticated grazing animals to replace those wild animals, or you don't get that ecological impact that they had on the globe, that they had on the soils, that they had on whole ecosystems. And so I feel very strongly that it isn't about mitigating damage. It's about being a positive ecological, force in whatever geography you're in. But you do have to, I don't mean you. Now, I'm not pointing a finger at anybody. I'm pointing it at myself, too. All of us have to be mindful of how we do things, to do things in the best possible way.
So you've mentioned a couple of times the different environmental groups that have come alongside. We've done an episode with the Audubon Society. Josh Lafers was our guest for episode 39.
Oh, great.
And then we've also done an episode with Nancy Lobby from the Sustainable Ranching Initiative with the World Wildlife Fund for episode 18 of the Working Cows podcast. Those will be linked in the show notes page at workingcows.net/57, as well as links to Nicolette's books and anything else she wants me to put up there to just get the information out there to as many people as possible. But I do want to ask one final question.
Sure.
What has been the driving force behind organizations like the Audubon Society and the Sustainable Ranching Initiative through the World Wildlife Fund? I don't know anybody, probably that I know of, more qualified than you to answer that question. What do you feel like has been the driving force behind that taking place?
Well, I realized a few years ago that most of the environmental groups that are out there today are urban based, and especially, we only have about 17% of Americans that are living in rural areas nowadays. And so our population is increasingly urban, and our organizations of all types are, even the agricultural organizations, a lot of them are kind of like in Washington, D.C. and so forth. So we really have this sort of incredible disconnect that's happening between advocacy groups a lot of times and then the places where the issues are actually happening. And I've been really struck by the fact that the environmental groups are very unfamiliar with how, sort of landscape function, as Charles Massey would say in his book, The Call of the Reed Warbler, which I recommend to everyone. It's a great new book that just came out of Australia about a lot of it is about the grazing animals and the way we can restore the earth with them. But people who are advocating, especially on environmental issues, are basically urban-based now and have very little understanding of how things are really happening out on the landscape. And one of the reasons I really believe in ranchers as the frontline stewards of the earth is because, I've been on lots of ranches, and I know on our own ranch, we are out there every day for a large portion of the day, and we really see what's happening. You know, we know what's happening with the soils. We know what's happening with the insect life. We know what's happening with the plant life, and we're far more focused to and attuned to changes in the weathers and all the things that are, you know, sort of affecting the, because it's so directly connected to with what we're doing. I mean, this is especially true with ranching as opposed to, you know, raising pigs or chickens, which are basically indoors nowadays. So I think there's a recognition from the groups that are more connected directly with land preservation or wildlife preservation. For example, you know, like I mentioned, I work for the National Wildlife Federation. They too are much more interested in working directly with ranchers because there's this recognition that these are the people who are actually out on the land every day. And in the United States, ranching has a huge impact on a large portion of the land. So whether you like ranching or not, you know, even if you're an urban vegan, it's there, right? So you need to talk to or somehow work with the people who are doing it and try to build a bridge there so that you can affect what they're doing, not just trying to, you know, eat them out of existence by not eating beef. But that's not going to work. I mean, so I think that the Audubon Society and National Wildlife Federation and the Nature Conservancy and a few other of these groups that are really working in a big way with ranching community. It's just this recognition that these are people that are actually out there on the landscape, and I think there's a recognition from many of those organizations that there is, in fact, a very strong conservation ethic within the ranching community and within most individual ranchers. So I hope that grows, and I'm trying to do everything I can to be part of making that grow more. And I just believe, as we were talking about earlier, that I liked your phrase, that coming at it with humility. To the extent that we are communicating that we are genuinely, we being ranching community, that we are genuinely listening and trying to understand any issues of what environmental impact what we're doing may be, but we're also learning about how to do things in a better way so that there is more protection of the soils, more protection of the vegetation, and fostering a healthier ecosystem through our grazing practices, we are going to keep building those bridges, I think, and more of it. And, I'm very optimistic, actually, because there is this tremendous regenerative ranching movement, and some of the people I've talked to about this have told me when they were giving talks about regenerative grazing, 20 years ago, they'd have two people in the audience, and now they're giving talks to 1,000 people in the ranching community at conferences, and so that says a lot to me. I think people are interested, people are trying to learn more, and I have a lot of hope that things are moving in the right direction.
Very good. Well, I appreciate your time today. Thank you so much. And I think that a lot of the driving force from the ranching side is a need to be able to support more than one generation on the same ranch and some of the bottom line issues that come up when it comes down to those things. And we're seeing a lot of people turn to these more regenerative methods as a way to support more than one family on the same ranch, on the same number of acres.
Absolutely. It's not sustainable, and it's not economically sustainable. There's no question about that.
Yep. Very good. Well, thank you for your time today. Are there any other links that you would like me to put up at the show notes page, workingcows.net/57?
No. Thank you for having me.
Really good stuff there with Nicolette. I really appreciate her taking time to sit down with me. I look forward to future conversations about her and the work that she is doing to spread the benefits of cows and why we need grazing animals performing some of the functions that other animals used to perform through high stock density with predators and all those different things. So really good stuff there. next week. Really, really interesting discussion coming up with Nate Chisholm, a very good guy that I'm really excited to welcome on the podcast and talk a little bit about kind of doing things a different way and thinking a little different about ranching as a whole. So come back next week for episode 58 of the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.